Shore Sheen Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everybody. This is Bill once again, and this is our Torah portion commentary on Vayeshev, Vayeshev, and he dwelt. This is taken from Bereshit, or Genesis chapter 37, verse 1, all the way over to chapter 40, verse 23. So in the previous Torah portion, it talks about a lot about Jacob's ordeal in confronting Esau, and then it makes a brief mention of Esau's family. The text is now going to turn back to Jacob's family, and primarily it's going to focus on Joseph, who is destined to be the leader of the family. Now, it mentions that Jacob settled, or he dwelt, in the land of his father's sojournings. The word yashev means to settle down, it means to dwell in peace, and it's related to the idea of sitting. And so this term implies that there is some permanency in Jacob's actions. He is intending to dwell in peace. He's intending to stay in one place, as opposed to sojourning or wandering. So is this to say then that Jacob had an intention of settling down permanently in Canaan at this point in time? Look at it from his perspective. He's fathered the 12 tribes. He's survived the exile in Syria. He survived the confrontation with Esau. He fulfilled his vow at Bethel. He's an old man. So he's probably thinking it would be nice now to kind of settle down. So he dwelt, or he began to settle in the land of Canaan. But now, as we know, he's not going to be able to stay there. And rabbinical commentary argues that it wasn't possible because his purpose was not yet complete. Nowhere are we guaranteed as God's people that we are going to be able to just sit quietly and idly by as the world passes us, because our mission as a people is to be a light, and light must go where the darkness is. Now Joseph, as we're going to see, is going to lead the way, but all of Israel, including Jacob, would follow. So the exile of Joseph into Egypt had to happen, because it had already been foretold to Abraham at the covenant of the pieces in Genesis chapter 15. But the question is, why did it have to happen at the hand of his brothers? Why didn't it happen because of someone else not related to the family? Perhaps the answer is that it has something to do with what would happen with the Messiah. Because in John chapter 1, verse 11, it says, he came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. And as we know, Joseph is going to be a prototype of the Messiah. So even though his brothers despised him and did not consider him their king, he was going to be a king anyway. We're talking about Joseph, even if it was among the Gentiles. And so wherever he went, he ruled, whether it was in Potiphar's house, whether it was in the prison house, or whether it was in Pharaoh's house. Wherever he went, he ruled. And that is exactly what we see in the Messiah, that his brethren didn't want him to rule over them, and yet he rules over them nonetheless. In Luke chapter 19, in verse 12, the Messiah said, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Of course, it's a parable about him. But in verse 14 of that parable, it says, but his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. In John chapter 19, verse 14, it says, now it was the day of the preparation of the Passover, and it was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. That's Pilate talking there. And they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. And so, just like Joseph, Messiah's brethren did not want him to rule over them. Yet, we know, he nonetheless will rule over them. And so the cruel action of the brothers is a prototype for things that would happen later, and these actions played a role in God's purposes. In Joseph's case, he was in Egypt so that he could be Israel's savior in a time of famine. And, of course, that's going to lay the groundwork for the exodus out of Egypt and the journey to Mount Sinai. Likewise, the rejection of Yeshua by his brethren laid the groundwork for God's greater purposes for all of mankind. Because in Psalm 18, verse 22, it says, "The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone." Now, also in this Torah portion, we're going to see that Judah descends, and that's the word it uses in Hebrew. He descends literally and figuratively. And this is after Joseph is rejected. So Judah descends after Joseph is rejected and sent away into Egypt. And of course, Judah is going to become entangled with the affair with Tamar. The two principles in Jacob's family, if you think about it, is Judah and Joseph. Judah's a leader. He's the ancestor of King David and the Messiah, by the way. Joseph has the birthright. And so in this Torah portion, we're going to see a contrast between Judah's failure and Joseph's virtue. We're going to see that both were tempted. Joseph resisted that temptation. Judah did not. Now, in rejecting Yeshua, Judah, now we're talking about the people, descended into a time of trouble after the Messiah was rejected. Joseph descended into Egypt, and he is regarded as a king among the nations. But a time of trouble is going to bring them both back together. And it's going to come through Judah's noble acts. I would say then, in the past, and because it's prophetic, in the future. It's going to be through Judah's acts that the two are restored back together. And then the king, we're talking about Joseph, but we're also talking about the Messiah. The king will reveal his true identity to his brothers, the very same people who rejected him. Now, as we begin the Torah portion, chapter 37, verse 1, it says, "And Jacob settled," and again, that term is Vayeshev, that's where we get our Torah portion name from. "And Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings. Jacob chose to live where his father had lived, in a land that was promised to them and to their seed. But they did this as aliens, in partial fulfillment of the prophecy that was given to Abraham," which is in Genesis 15, verse 13. "The Lord said to Avram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. The partial fulfillment of that, of course, is when they're in Egypt. But they weren't in Egypt 400 years. Before that, they were sojourning in the land of Canaan. And so Jacob chose to live there because that's the land that was promised to his fathers, to him, and to his seed after him. In verse 2, it says, "These are the generations of Jacob," although only Joseph is going to be mentioned by name, because, again, Joseph's going to be at the center of the events that are described for the rest of the book of Genesis. In verse 2, it also says that Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, still a lad. Now, tradition states that at this point in time, Jacob was 108 years old. Isaac, who was still alive, was 168 years old. In fact, Isaac would live another 12 years. This is said to have occurred about 9 years after Jacob had arrived back into the land. When it says that Joseph was feeding the flock, the word actually suggests supervising. Thus, it mentions that he was a lad. So even when he was a young man, he was a ruler. He was supervising. The word roe. Roe comes from the root word ra'ah, and it means to tend, to shepherd, to rule. And thus we have an alternate rendering of this particular verse from some other translations. It says, "Joseph, being 17 years old, used to supervise, although only a lad, his brethren, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, when they were with the sheep." In other words, he was supervising the flocks, but in reality supervising the other sons of Jacob through Bilhah and through Zilpah. He was overseeing those other brothers who were then tending the flocks. So it suggests that he may have been placed in charge, it seems, only of the sons of the handmaids, although they are still regarded as his father's wives. But you can see what's going to happen. This young boy is going to be supervising them, and that's going to create some animosity. By the way, by this time, both Rachel and Leah had died. Now, verse 2, it also says this, "that Joseph brought an evil report of them unto their father." And so that he was a young man suggests that he was very immature. he lacked discretion. In fact, the word report means to weaken, and it implies slander. He was defaming someone. At least that's what's implied by the word that's used. In fact, the word evil here is ra'ah. Ra'ah. Resh ein hey. Which is interesting because it's spelled identically to the word for feeding or supervising, roeh, which is resh ein hey. Kind of interesting. So all of this is to suggest that his youthful immaturity, his indiscretion, led him to belittle these brothers at, of course, a great expense. Now, verse 3, it tells us that Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age. Benjamin, of course, would still be a toddler at this point. And later on, after Joseph is exiled, Benjamin's going to take the place of Joseph as the son of his old age. But if he is loved by his father more than all of the other brethren, obviously this is going to provoke jealousy. It's going to provoke hatred among his brothers. Now, was this love that Jacob placed upon Joseph, was it just because of Rachel? Or was there some perceived spiritual superiority over the brothers? In other words, did he sense something in Joseph that he didn't sense in his other sons? Have to keep in mind, God chose Jacob, Israel, over Esau. Abraham preferred Isaac. In fact, throughout the scripture, we see that the favored ones were, in fact, the true protectors of the covenant. And so the fact that Jacob is referred to here as Israel hints that maybe in Joseph, he sees or perceives that Joseph is going to be the guardian of the covenant. He's really going to be the spiritual superior in this particular situation, and maybe that's why he preferred him over his brothers. It might also suggest that Joseph has been favored with the knowledge that Jacob has obtained. Joseph endured his exile, which was about 22 years, that is, before he was reunited with his brethren, without succumbing to temptation and despair. Jacob, of course, was able to endure his exile, which was about 22 years, and he emerges blessed rather than beaten down. In verse 3, it tells us that Jacob made him a coat of many colors. An alternate rendering is a fine woolen tunic. In fact, the idea that it was a many or multicolored coat is a translation that is based on the Septuagint and the Targum of Jonathan. However, in Semitic cultures, we do know that multicolored coats signified rulership. For example, in 2 Samuel chapter 13, verse 18, she was one of the daughters of the kings, she had a garment of diverse colors or multicolors upon her, for with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins appareled. And so there is this idea in that culture that a multicolored coat signified someone that had been given authority, who was a ruler over the others. And so then a coat that was given by Jacob to Joseph was signaling to the other brothers that Joseph was going to rule the family when Jacob died. In short, it elevated Joseph to the status of being the firstborn. Now, the coat, the evil reports that he brought against his brethren, his vanity in reciting the dreams, all of this fuels his brothers' contempt for him. And in verse 4, it tells us that they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. They couldn't even bear to talk to him. In Genesis 37, verses 5 through 7, it tells us then, "And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves came round about and bowed down to my sheaf." Now, these were no typical dreams. Obviously, heaven was validating for the family that Joseph was going to rule the family. Yet, we could argue that his youth, his immaturity, would not allow him to be silent about it. He's going to spout off about it. So, there's a footnote, as far as I'm concerned, to this that applies to those of us who are in the Messianic movement. There are some in the Messianic movement that when God shows you something or shows us something, we think that it is our obligation to go share it with everybody and to make sure everybody gets it and that everybody agrees with it. And sometimes that gets us in a lot of trouble. Sometimes it creates more trouble than you could argue than what it's worth at that point in time. My point is, we learn from Joseph's story that, you know, his brethren were not ready to hear what he had to say at that particular time. And so immaturity and youthfulness and indiscretion leads to saying things that maybe shouldn't be said at that point in time. Maybe there's a point in time later on that you're to say them. At any rate, let's get back to the Torah portion. The sheaves in the dream hint that they're going to bow to him, of course, but they're also going to bow to him because of their need for grain, the sheaves being sheaves of grain. That his remained standing indicated that he was going to rule over them and implied for a long time. In fact, Joseph was believed to be the viceroy of Egypt for about 80 years. But all of this, as far as I'm concerned, ultimately alludes to Yeshua, who is going to reign forever. In Luke chapter 1, verse 33, when announcing that he was coming into the world, the angel said, "And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end." Now that the sheaves bowed down to Joseph, and Joseph ultimately being a picture of the Messiah, but I would also argue the body of Messiah, that they bowed down reminds me of other scriptures, and one pertaining to the Messiah, and the other pertaining to the congregation of Philadelphia. In Philippians, here's what Paul says in chapter 2 in regard to bowing to the Messiah. "Wherefore also God highly exalted him, and gave unto him the name which is above every name, that in the name of Yeshua every knee should bow, of things in heaven, and things on earth, and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Yeshua is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." But as it pertains to Joseph representing the body of Messiah, Revelation chapter 3, verse 9, Yeshua says this, "Behold, I give of the synagogue of Satan, of them that say they are Jews, and they are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you." Those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be brothers, if you will, but aren't, are going to be forced to come and bow before you. That is the congregation of Philadelphia, those who are of brotherly love, but who, it says, keep my commandments and do not deny my name. When looking at Philadelphia, it's also easy to see that they are similar to Joseph in that they had little strength. They had been through trials. And so having been through trials, their strength worn out, still they don't deny his name. They still are faithful to his commands. And so others will have to come and bow before their feet. Now verse 8, it says that the brothers ask, "Shall you reign over us, or shall you have dominion over us?" And they hated him even more. To reign over us is said to signify as a king. And as a king, you have the consent of the governed. But when they say to have dominion over us, that is indicating that someone would rule over them against their will. In either case, and here's what the brothers are saying, they are not going to allow that to happen. They're not going to comply. They're not going to consent to be governed, and they're certainly not going to allow him to do it against their will. And so they hate him for the dreams, and it says, and for his words. They hated him because of what he was saying. And again, keeping in mind that Joseph is a picture of the Messiah, you think about all of the people who were angered at him to the point of wanting to try to kill him, and typically it was because of his words. Now, either Joseph is oblivious to their hatred, or he just doesn't care because he has another dream and he doesn't hesitate to relate that dream to them as well. In verses 9 through 11, it says, "And he dreamed yet another dream and told it to his brothers and said, 'Behold, I have dreamed yet another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars bowed to me.' And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, 'What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to you to the earth. And his brethren envied him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now the fact that the same theme is repeated in this dream makes it a certainty. In fact, this is something that Joseph himself validates later in Genesis chapter 41, verse 32. But now why does Jacob rebuke him? Is it because the sun and moon, which represents father and mother, are mentioned? Does he rebuke him because of his indiscretion in saying something that's going to incite envy and more hatred? It doesn't really expound upon that. It just says that he rebuked him for it. As I said, that the dream was repeated means that it is something that God is establishing. And so apparently that became a sign to the brothers that these dreams are from God, and that causes their hatred to become envy. Because it would be difficult to consent to the spiritual authority and superiority of a younger brother. In fact, coupled with that, Joseph is Rachel's son. And that means he is of the one who is Leah's rival, and all of the animosity that goes back even years before this. But it also says that Jacob pondered these things in his heart. Perhaps he is thinking in his heart that his choice for Joseph as the head of the family, so to speak, has received divine approval. At any rate, it's clear that his brothers were not ready to hear what he had to say, regardless if it came from God. And that, to me, again, is very striking when you continue to see that Joseph is a picture of the Messiah. They realized that what Joseph was revealing to them was from God, but they rejected it anyway. They hated him for it anyway. Because you can't convince someone of something they're not ready to be convinced of. Those who are hearing from God need to keep in mind that zeal that is not tempered with wisdom can lead to some undesirable consequences. Now, later on, because Joseph was faithful, because he had learned wisdom, that he had gained the Spirit of God, that he had learned discretion, then he was prepared to share with them God's purposes. But that's years down the road, and by that time, God had changed the circumstances. In other words, then they were ready to hear what Joseph had to say. But Joseph had to learn wisdom, discretion, had to be full of the Spirit of God. And so all parties involved here learned something from this experience. Now in verse 12 through 14, it says, his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, or Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. And he said to him, here I am. And so he said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word. And so he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Now, to me, number one, it's interesting that they would choose to go back to where they had slaughtered men. That was at Shechem. Maybe time has passed and the incident has been forgotten. Or it may be that the people in that area are still overcome with the fear that God had placed upon them. But now notice that it is Israel, not Jacob, that sends Joseph on this journey. And perhaps that is to imply that what's about to occur is a great spiritual matter, and that's why he's referred to as Israel. Because Joseph's journey is going to lead him down into Egypt, and of course that's going to result ultimately in the Exodus and then going to Mount Sinai. On the surface, it seems that Jacob's putting him in a very bad situation because Jacob is aware of the animosity that his brothers have for him. Joseph goes knowing that it's a volatile situation. So it seems that there is something spiritual afoot here. Seeing that Joseph is a type of the Messiah, then what we see in this part of the story is the father sends him on this fateful journey, knowing that his brethren hate him and that they wish to get rid of him. And the son, like Joseph, is also aware of this. But nevertheless, he consents to go without delay. Now, verse 14, it says that he sent him from the valley of Hebron, which is interesting because Hebron is situated on a mountain. The word emek, ayin mem kuf, It's from a root word that means depth and can even mean profound. And so this leads to speculation that more is being hinted at here. It's hinting that he is sending him from the depths of Hebron. Something profound is being carried out. Now, Abraham, of course, is buried in Hebron. And so that is to suggest that when he sends him from the depths, if you will, of Hebron, that something related to the prophecy given to Abraham is about to be fulfilled. In fact, tradition has it that Jacob takes Joseph to the tomb at Machpelah, where the tomb of Abraham is, and he sends him on this journey from there. So it's kind of an interesting thing to consider. He sends him from the valley of Hebron, and yet Hebron is on a mountain. So, again, that leads to the speculation that something is being hinted at here. Joseph is, in fact, going on a very fateful journey. Now, verse 15, here's a verse that, in my opinion, kind of lends to this. It says, "A man found him as he," that is Joseph, "wandered in the field. And the man asked, 'What do you seek?'" And this statement to me is pregnant with possible hints. Number one, Joseph is in a field near Shechem. By the way, later on, that's where he's going to be buried. That's where the allotment is going to be given to his sons. It says that he was lost in this field. As he went seeking the flocks of his father and looking for his brothers. So he's lost searching for the flock of his father. He's lost searching for his brethren. And a man asked him, "What are you seeking?" So keep it in mind that Joseph is emblematic of those who are separated from the family, those who will be living among the nations. And here he is looking for his father's flock, searching for his brothers, and he's lost. So as far as I'm concerned, that suggests that Joseph, because of all that he represents, is emblematic of the lost sheep. Ezekiel 34, verse 11 says, "For thus says the Lord God, behold, I myself will search for my sheep and will seek them out. As a shepherd seeks out his flock when he is among his sheep that have been scattered, so will I seek out my sheep, and I will rescue them from all the places where they have been scattered on a day of clouds and thick darkness. And I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries and will bring them into their own land. And I will feed them on the mountains of Israel by the ravines and in all the inhabited places of the country. I will feed them with good pasture, and on the mountain heights of Israel shall be their grazing land. There they shall lie down in good grazing land, and on rich pasture they shall feed on the mountains of Israel. I myself will be the shepherd of my sheep, and I myself will make them lie down, declares the Lord God. I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the injured, and I will strengthen the weak, and the fat and the strong I will destroy. I will feed them in justice." So in this prophecy, God himself is going to seek for his lost sheep. And who are his lost sheep? They are those who have been scattered among the nations. They've been living outside the land, cut off from the rest of the family. So he says that he's going to gather them from the countries, and that speaks to those who have been living among the nations. That's what Joseph was bound to do. It also says that he will bring them to the mountains of Israel. And that phrase that's repeated a couple of times there alludes to what the world now calls the West Bank. And that is territory that has been deeded primarily to the sons of Joseph. Now, another passage of scripture in the New Testament that I believe hints at this as well is in Luke chapter 15, when Messiah is talking about the lost sheep. I don't believe this is just some random story he concocted. He's making a statement. So he says, beginning in verse 4, "What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country," or some translations say wilderness, "and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost.' Just so, I tell you, There will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents or returns, and that's the implication of the word repent, to return to the Father, to return to his ways, to return to the heritage. There will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance or no returning. So in my mind, the idea here is what's going to take place anyways. Joseph is the one who's going to be cut off from the rest. And what is his father's reaction? He's lost his son. He grieves his son. And what happens when they're reunited later? He rejoices. He had the others with him all the time. But the one that was lost was a thorn in his side. And so he rejoiced over that. And so again, I believe that there's a hint here that Joseph is representing that lost sheep. Now, rabbinical commentary suggests that this man, who is unnamed, was actually an angel that was sent to help Joseph. Joseph tells the man, "I seek my brothers." But he doesn't give him any other helpful information, at least nothing that is recorded. And so what is this lost one seeking? "I'm looking for my brothers. I'm looking for my family." And he asks the man, "Where are they feeding the flock? Where's the flock? Where are the 99, if you will?" In verse 17, here's what the man says. "They are departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" And so Joseph finds them in Dothan, which, according to one lexicon, says that it means two wells. Another suggestion is that it comes from the word dat, which is dalet tav, which is a decree, a law. It's implying that it's something to put, it's something to place, it's something to do, something that has to happen, if we can put it that way. Now, what transpires next is something that had to happen. It is something that God decreed to Abraham. By the way, Dothan is where Elisha, the prophet, lived, and he was surrounded by the angelic hosts, and that's in 2 Kings. That has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's just a footnote there. Now, verse 18, it says that the brothers, they saw him afar off, and before he came near, they conspired to kill him. They saw him as an enemy of them all. Now, is that prophetic? Considering that, again, Joseph is a picture of the Messiah. There are those who, even though he's their brother, sees him as an enemy. In Genesis 37, verse 19 through 20, it says, "They said to one another, 'Here comes this dreamer,'" literally this master of dreams. "Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." Remember, they know that God is giving these dreams to him. But then they're still conspiring to kill him and say, "Then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. Then we'll see what becomes of his words." Now, the pit that he's going to be thrown into is actually a cistern where water was stored, of course, because in verse 24 it tells us there was no water in it. I bring that out because in Jerusalem, there is a place there just outside of the old city, a traditional spot where it is believed that Yeshua was confined by Caiaphas. And I've been there several times. What's interesting about it, this place that they say he was confined, this dungeon, was in reality a cistern. Now, the Midrash, which is Jewish commentary, suggests that Shimon, was the one who actually made the proposal to kill him. Now, remember, Simeon is the one who joined Levi in Shechem to kill all the men there. And if he was the one that did this, that might explain why Joseph will later keep him in Egypt in a pit. That's recorded in Genesis 42, verse 24. Now, Reuben hears of the plan, and he is going to try to thwart the plan. It says in verse 21 and 22, "But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, 'Let us not take his life.' And Reuben said to them, 'Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father.'" So this strongly suggests that Reuben, the one who's lost his birthright to Joseph, this very one they're conspiring to kill, to me it says Reuben learned his lesson. He's repented. And it also says that he recognizes that as the firstborn, he's going to bear the brunt of Jacob's displeasure should Joseph get killed or anything else bad happen to him. All of us who are firstborns know that when anything happens amongst the children, the oldest one is looked to as being ultimately responsible because they could have stopped it, they could have done something to change it, they know better, etc. Things haven't changed. It was that way apparently then as well. And even though he is going to try to deliver Joseph, he still doesn't protest against their plan per se, just he protests murdering him with their hands. Even though he has plans to save Joseph, he is suggesting to them, let's don't murder him with our hands, let's put him in the pit so he'll starve. But again, he's intending to deliver him out of the pit later on. But now, had he consented to this plan, his nemesis, if you will, in that Joseph has been given the birthright, would have been removed out of the picture. Verse 23, it says, when Joseph came near his brothers, they stripped him of his coat of many colors. In essence, what they did was to strip him of his identity, that designated him as ruler. And the phrasing in the text implies that they removed it very violently, which to me is reminiscent of Yeshua being stripped of his robe. Now, there is no record that Joseph resisted. We can only assume. But what is recorded is in Genesis chapter 42, verse 21. Later on, they said this to one another. In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. In other words, even though there is nothing said here about Joseph pleading with them, obviously that is indeed what happened. And when they put him in the pit, he's begging them, but they won't listen to him. So in verses 24 through 5, they cast him into the empty cistern, and then they sat down to eat a meal. Now, if we read this very carefully, it would seem that Reuben was not there for the meal, and he certainly wasn't there for the sale into slavery. Because in verse 25, it says, they looked and saw an Ishmaelite caravan coming from Gilead heading to Egypt. Dothan, as I understand it, lays upon a trade route that stretches from Gilead, goes through the valley of Jezreel, and goes all the way down to Egypt. And so at this point, in verse 26, it says, then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. He's a leader. Now, there are some commentators that want to argue that Judah is actually saving Joseph from death. And in a technical way, that would be correct. Yet, Judah is the one who comes up with the idea of selling him into slavery, making a profit, and not being guilty of murder at the same time. In other words, we don't want to do the really bad thing and murder him, but we will separate him from his family. We will sell him into slavery against his will, and we'll make money doing it. How are we going to be better off if he's just dead? Let's just send him away as a slave and make a little profit off of it. And so Judah sways the other brothers into consenting to this, and in doing that, he displays his leadership role, perhaps not in the best way, but nonetheless displays that he is a leader among the brothers. So in verse 28, it says, then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. So there is a question here as to who did what. In other words, who are the they in the phrase, they drew Joseph up from the pit, seeing that it is just mentioned Midianite traders. Are the brothers the one bringing him up out of the pit, or are the Midianite traders bringing him up out of the pit? And so that brings up the question, who actually did sell Joseph? Who actually took him into Egypt? One interpretation is that the brothers actually sold him to the Ishmaelites, who then sold him to the Midianites, and then the Midianites sold him to the Egyptians. In other words, he may have been sold several times. Another interpretation is that while the brothers are eating their meal, some Midianites happen by, see him in the pit, hurt him, and are drawing him up out of the pit. and they take him, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites, who then took him into Egypt and sold him. It does say in Genesis 40, verse 15, that Joseph said that he was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. And if that is the case, and we're not arguing that it is or isn't, but if that's the case, the brothers didn't profit. All they did was make it possible for him to be taken. Now, later on, Joseph indicates the brothers sold him. The question is, did they do it directly or indirectly? But at any rate, he sold into slavery. Now, in verse 29 and 30, when Reuben returned to the pit, he doesn't find Joseph. He rends his clothes, and now he laments that he has no place to go. Why? Because he perceives he will be held responsible. And this incident is going to cost Jacob, the father, 22 years of grief, thinking that his son is gone, or is lost, or is dead. In verses 31 through 32, the brothers send the coat, and that they sent the coat implies that they apparently sent it through other people, but they sent it to Jacob dipped in goat's blood. And the blood was to provide the evidence that Joseph was dead, yet we know he lives. Let me say that again. The blood provides the evidence that Joseph was dead, and yet he lives. Evidence was left in the tomb that Yeshua had died, yet he lives. And in both cases, Joseph and Yeshua, they had only gone away to receive a kingdom. Now the brothers, in sending it by someone else, they are going to avoid the scene when Jacob realizes what has happened. In verse 33, when he receives the coat, he says, "It is my son's coat. A beast has devoured him. No doubt Joseph is torn in pieces." It literally says, "My son's coat. A wild beast has eaten him. Torn, torn is Joseph." Now that word torn, because it's repeated there, it's emphasized there, says, let's take note of that. The term torn is the root word taraf. Tet resh fe, taraf. It means to tear, to pluck, to snatch. And in some cases, to snatch as if it's going to be used for food. In other words, a wild beast has torn him, has snatched him to use him for food. But what I found interesting about this is that this is the same word that's used in Hosea 6 when talking about Ephraim or the house of Israel, Ephraim being Joseph's son. In Hosea 6, verse 1 and 2, it says this, "Come, let us return to the Lord." Remember, the lost sheep returns, repents. "Let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us," and that Hebrew word is taraf. "He has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down, and he will bind us up." The reason we're torn, in other words, is so that he can heal us. When is he going to do this? "After 2 days he will revive us, and on the third day he will raise us up that we may live before him." Footnote to this is that later on, when Joseph is restored to his brothers, or his brothers are restored to him, and the two come together as one, it will be on their third meeting. Or let's put it this way, on the third day. Now, verse 34, it says that Jacob rent his garments and mourned for his son many days. In fact, some commentators say 22 years. He refused to be comforted, it says. He says, "I will go to my grave mourning Joseph." Rabbis believe that Jacob considered Joseph's death to be a punishment brought upon Jacob for some sin. What's interesting to me is that 22 years, that is the time that Jacob was separated from Joseph, seems to be anyway, equivalent to the time that Jacob was separated from his father Isaac. He was 20 years in Syria, and according to some calculations, it was about 2 years from the time he left Syria until the time he was actually reunited with Isaac. 22 years. Kind of an interesting thing. Verse 36 says, "Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar." That word or that name means gift of Ra. "And so he was sold to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, or an alternate translation here is the chief executioner. So as we pause there in the Torah portion, it takes us on a journey with Judah. In chapter 38, verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass that Judah went down," literally descended, "from his brethren." If this is in chronological order, this is after Joseph has been sold into slavery. So some commentators suggest that after the events involving Joseph, Judah's wanting to sell him into slavery, Jacob's grief, etc., that for a little while Judah was deposed. And that's why he went to his friend Hira the Adullamite. Now, he is going to lose two sons in this Torah portion. And so he's going to experience the same grief that he caused his father. In fact, later on in this chapter, he's going to be asked, "Identify, if you please." And that's regarding the tokens that he had left with Tamar. And these were the same words that were posed to Jacob in regard to the tunic that had been dipped in blood. "Identify these, please, if they are your sons." So we're going to see measure for measure where Judah is concerned here. Now, verse 2, it says that Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite, and he took her and went in unto her. And of course, she got pregnant. He took her as a wife. So to me, it's striking that Judah would take a wife from among the Canaanites, like his uncle Esau did. Because Abraham sent his servant Eliezer to Syria to fetch a wife for Isaac. Isaac sent Jacob to Padan Aram to find a wife. So why is there this seeming lapse of protocol? Well, we see that some not so good things are going to come about because of this union. In verses 3 and 5, it records Judah's sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. By the way, Shelah, it says, was born in Kesiv, which means deluded. To me, it puts that name there, that place there, which means deluded, for a reason, inferring that Judah, at this point in time, was deluded. He was deceived into a falsehood, which is also the word kasav, which is related to Kesiv. Now, what was the delusion? What was the deception? Was it the incident with Tamar? Or was it the incident into taking a strange wife? Or was it both? Because the situation with the Tamar gets more attention. But which is the worst situation here? What was the delusion? Personally, the first delusion, as far as I'm concerned, is that he takes the Canaanite wife. I say that because it's noteworthy to point out that Tamar, who does things that most of us would disagree with, nonetheless, Tamar becomes the mother of the Davidic dynasty by Judah. In fact, she is called more righteous than I by Judah himself. Some rabbinic commentary goes so far as to say that she was actually a daughter of a stranger or an alien in the land of Canaan as well. And so she wasn't actually a Canaanite woman. So all of that is to say, Judah descends. He is deluded, hinted at by the place Chesiv, where he dwelt. And it seems to me that he's more deluded into taking a Canaanite wife as opposed to being deluded into the affair with Tamar. At any rate, it says in verse 6 of chapter 38, "And Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar." So he takes Tamar for his son. Tamar means a date palm. The root word here signifies something that rises to great heights, and it's used in connection with clouds that are rising or tall trees that are used as signal posts. And so it seems apropos, considering that Tamar's descendants are going to be the first king of Israel, David, but it's going to be the king of Israel, the Messiah himself. In verse 7, it says that Er, the firstborn, was wicked, and God caused him to die. Now, it doesn't say what he did or doesn't say what he didn't do, but there is a hint found for us in verse 9 because of something his brother does. And so that leads some to believe that Er did the same thing that Onan did. What did they do? They spilled their seed on the ground rather than impregnating Tamar. because it tells us that Onan his brother did evil in the sight of the Lord, just as Er did. Verse 8, it tells us that Judah said to Onan after Er's death, "Go into your brother's wife and raise up seed to your brother." In other words, perform the duty of a brother in a levirate marriage. Levirate comes from the Latin word levir, which is brother-in-law. So the idea here is that the brother-in-law, upon his brother's death, if his brother left no sons, then he is to go in and take his sister-in-law now as a wife and raise up seed in his brother's name. In Hebrew, it's called yevum, to raise up progeny. And we find the commandment for it in Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Now, here, the Torah has not been written, but it's still known by Jacob's family, which tells me that Jacob's family were keeping the Torah even before it was written down, which tells me that the Torah didn't begin at Mount Sinai. The Torah has always been. The Torah will forever be. This belief apparently was unknown in other cultures. Because you remember, Ruth had to be informed to go to Boaz. In verses 9 and 10, we see that for selfish reasons, Onan goes into her, but he doesn't fulfill his duties. He made his seed to spill upon the ground. So he does evil by Tamar as well. And this would strongly suggest this is what Er did. And they both die for it. Verse 11, as a result of this, Judah promises Tamar that when his son Shelah is old enough, that he will allow her to marry him then. So Tamar is told to go back to her father's house and wait as a widow. And she's waiting for the day that she's going to be wed to Shelah. And some commentators go into this and surmise that Judah says this because he has come to the opinion that Tamar is responsible for his son's deaths. And so for this reason, he's not going to allow her to marry Shelah. He's just going to put it off and say, this is what we're going to do, but never really intending to do it. Maybe it's because he truly wants him to grow and to mature so that he will do the right thing as not to die like his brothers. But for whatever reason, Judah delays this marriage, or he refuses to give Shelah to Tamar as a husband. So in verses 13 through 15, it says, "And when Tamar was told, 'Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep,' she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. And when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face." So it would seem to me that Tamar is very determined to have children from Judah, directly or indirectly. Now, to resort to this method, on one hand, to many would seem repugnant. But it could be argued that if she were a Canaanite woman, and we don't know for sure, but if she was, what she was doing would have been quite acceptable in their view. She obviously intended at this point in time that Judah himself was going to perform the duty that his other sons did not. We could also argue that, in a way, Judah has kind of forced this upon her because he wasn't true to his word. And so as he goes to her, she's going to require that he give her tokens that are going to prove that her pregnancy was the result of a levirate marriage, not a illegitimate situation. In other words, she wasn't a common harlot. And that word is zana, which means to be unfaithful. She wasn't being unfaithful, is the implication. In verse 21, she is referred to as a kadesha. And that means to be set apart. In fact, it's just the feminine form of the word kadosh. But this term is often used referring to those who have been set apart for impure pagan worship. Now, that's an interesting consideration, seeing that Judah went to her voluntarily. Because that is going to be a forbidden practice in Israel. You can read about that in Deuteronomy 23, verse 17. My point here is, She is neither. She is no, she's not set apart for impure pagan worship. That's the way she's perceived. She's not the common harlot and someone that's just being unfaithful. She took tokens from Judah that will prove that her pregnancy is the result of something that should have been in the first place. Of course, it should have come through Er or Onan or Shelah. But because Judah didn't keep his word, it ends up being performed by Judah himself. In verse 17, having promised her a goat, she asks for a pledge or a token of his promise that he's going to pay her. And so he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. And then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. So in that, we again see she had no plans of being a harlot. She had no plans of being a temple prostitute. Her plan all along was that she have children by Judah, either directly or indirectly. Now, the things that she asked for would have been considered the insignia of a sheikh in Canaan, and they would absolutely identify the father of her child. Now, when he could not find her, or when she could not be found by those he sent to deliver the goat and recover the tokens, he calls off the search because he doesn't want to be put to shame. In verse 24, it says, "It came to pass 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar has played the harlot." And so as the head of the family, here's Judah's response, "Let her be burned." If he had never intended to give his son to her, and if he thinks she is responsible for his son's death, here is a very convenient way to get rid of the problem. "Let her be burned," he says. Now, rabbinical commentary suggests it's because she was the daughter of a priest. Earlier I said some commentators suggest that she was considered a stranger among the Canaanites as well. Here, rabbinical commentary says that she was actually the daughter of Shem. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. It's an interesting consideration. But nonetheless, he sentences her to be burned because if she's the daughter of a priest, the Torah says that the daughter of a priest who plays the harlot is to be burned. Compared to her response, Judah's seems very rash, very impulsive, because look at what it says about her response to all this. "As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, 'By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant.' And she said, 'Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.' Then Judah identified them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not know her again.'" Tamar acts nobly in that she did not identify the father of her child in her defense. She sent word, just like the brothers did when Joseph's coat was sent to Jacob. And so we see that Judah is repaid measure for measure because the message is, please identify these. That's the same message that was sent to Jacob from the brothers. Maybe the irony of the situation is not lost on Judah, and that is what provokes him to confess that she is more righteous than I. And that suggests that she was acting righteously all along. Now, in verses 27 through 30, it says, "When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, 'This one came out first.' But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out, and she said, 'What a breach you have made for yourself.' Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah." So at this point, we could say that twins certainly seem to run in this family because there are other twins, Esau, Jacob, and they were struggling in the womb. This seems to describe another struggle. But the firstborn was named Zerah. Zerah means shining. It means brightness. Perhaps it's alluding to the brightness of the crimson thread. But anyway, that's what it means. The crimson thread was used to mark the firstborn, in this case, the firstborn of the flesh. Yet we're going to see that the line of David and the Messiah did not come through Zerah, but come through Peretz. And Peretz means to break through. So this ignites this question. Are the sons of Judah, the line of the Messiah, born illegitimately? You have to consider that Rahab also comes into the line of the Messiah as well. Here's how I will answer that. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Of course, the Messiah was not born illegitimately. The Messiah didn't have an earthly father. He didn't have seed in that respect. He was conceived by the Holy Spirit. But the Messianic line, the Davidic line, has a very interesting past. But God takes those things that seem to be bad and he turns them for good. Now, Zerach, shining, is said to allude to the sun, whose light, of course, is always constant. Peretz alludes to the moon, whose light is sometimes full, it's sometimes hidden, it's breached, it waxes and wanes, and therefore it's considered breached. So, the Davidic line comes through Peretz, which demonstrates that the Davidic line waxed and waned. At times it seems to have disappeared, but like the moon, reappears. And right now it seems to have disappeared, but like the moon, it will reemerge and it will grow full again. In fact, every new moon that's declared, it's stated that David, king of Israel, lives. And the fullness of David's kingship, the fullness of the moon, if you will come under the kingship of the Messiah. In the beginning of Scripture, the brightness, Zerach, of the Messiah is hinted at by let there be light. And yet we only see his hand at work. Remember, the hand came out first. We only see his hand at work throughout the Tanakh. But like Zerach, he, in a sense, withdraws. But later, he emerges as Peretz. You see, as Yeshua, his light was concealed beneath this veneer of flesh. In other words, kind of like the moon. But on the Mount of Transfiguration, his brightness was revealed. His true light was revealed. It's also interesting to me that Peretz alludes to the breaker. The Hebrew term there is haporetz. We find that in Micah chapter 2. And that's related to the role of John the Baptist. That's in Matthew 11. We won't have time to develop that. So all of these things factor into it. And so when the Messiah returns to this world, we will see him in the brightness of his shining. In fact, we're told in 2 Thessalonians that he will destroy the wicked with the brightness of his coming. In Revelation 21:23, we're told, and the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. So all of that is to say that in the birth of Judah's sons here through this very extraordinary circumstance, I see pictures of the Messiah. I see shades of the Messiah even in this. Okay, now we come to chapter 39. Beginning at verse 1 and 2, it says, now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, or the chief executioner, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. There's one commentator that says that this was during or just before the reign of the Hyksos kings. And what makes that interesting is that the Hyksos hint at Edom, or Esau, which we read about in the previous Torah portion. But at any rate, it says that this Potiphar was an Egyptian. It made a point of calling him an Egyptian, as if to say there were some in Egypt who were not. Thus the Hyksos, the hint at Edom. At any rate, again, three times it mentions Potiphar as being an Egyptian in an attempt to call notice to it, or at least it seems that way. So Joseph goes down into Egypt and will become subject to Egypt and to an Egyptian. And hence, prophetically, at those who are Joseph, those who are separated among the nations. Yet all the while the Lord was with Joseph, and he caused him to prosper in everything he did. In fact, in verse 3, even his master realized that the Lord was with him. And so consequently, in verse 4, we see that Joseph found favor in his sight, and he ministered unto him and was appointed overseer. So first, Joseph serves as his personal attendant, and then he's appointed over Potiphar's entire household. And from that point forward, the Lord blessed Potiphar's house for Joseph's sake. And I would add to that, in the future, what we see is all of Egypt will be blessed for Joseph's sake. And so then prophetically, Egypt, metaphorically speaking of the world, all the nations, would be blessed for Joseph's sake. And when I say Joseph there, I mean those who Joseph represents, those who are living amongst the nations, yet are the seed of Abraham. Now, the trust that Potiphar placed in Joseph was such that he didn't even take notice of what was going on in his own house, because he was a blessed man. And why? Because the seed of Abraham was in his house. In verse 6, it says that Joseph was of beautiful form and fair to look upon, just like his mother Rachel. And incidentally, Jacob's love for Rachel led to his imprisonment, so to speak, in Syria to her father Laban. Joseph's beauty is going to lead him to be imprisoned. In chapter 39, verses 7 through 9, it says, "And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?'" Now, considering that the Hebrews were despised by the Egyptians, it's, first of all, exceptional that Joseph is even in the position that he is. That Potiphar's wife would try to seduce him is kind of interesting, because the Hebrews were despised by the Egyptians. So then, the fact that she does try to seduce him is hinting at his exceptional qualities, not just his beautiful form and that he's fair to look upon. I'm kind of the opinion that perhaps, in addition to the fact that he was an attractive young man, that she's also attracted to other qualities in his ability to run the household the way it does and for things to prosper the way it does. And even beyond that, maybe she's attracted to something that's in him that she doesn't even recognize, doesn't detect, and that's the call that God has placed upon his life and his destiny. And I say that because I have known of situations where that exact situation has happened, where there's been someone who's attracted to another party, not so much because of their looks, but because of their qualities, their characteristics. And in some specific cases, I believe it was because of the call that was upon that person's life. So how can I prove this? Well, I can't, obviously, but I kind of wonder if that didn't have something to do with it, that she's not only attracted to his natural looks, but there are those characteristics that he demonstrates and manifests that she's attracted to those things as well. Or is it that she's just that wicked? Whatever the reason, Joseph tells her that he can't sin against God. Now, she may or may not appreciate that, but not only is he doesn't want to sin against God, but he can't do this wickedness against his master, a man who has put his complete trust in Joseph. So in verse 11, it says, "And it came to pass when he went into the house, there was none of the men there." That's a big mistake right there. He's young, he's immature, perhaps naive, and he makes a fatal error here by being alone with her. Could he not have known that this might happen? Didn't it cross his mind? And if it did, then there is a lack of wisdom here. There is a lack of discretion. So in verse 12, it says that she caught him by his garment and he fled out of the house. Now, twice now, Joseph's garment, what he was wearing, is going to get him in trouble. It's caused him trouble. The multicolored coat, that got him in trouble. What that represented got him in trouble. And now the coat that he flees from, then he leaves with Potiphar's wife, that got him in trouble. Nevertheless, there are some things that you just simply must flee from. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul tells us to flee from sexual immorality, which obviously that's what this was trying to be here. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. So in verses 13 through 15, Potiphar's wife, as we see, used the garment and the Egyptians' disdain for Hebrews against Joseph. Consider that if there are servants in the house besides Joseph and they are Egyptian, well, the Egyptians don't like the Hebrews. So for Joseph to be in the house with them is going to insult these other Egyptian servants. And so she appealed to the Egyptian prejudice against Hebrews. They were known not to even eat with Hebrews. We can see that in Genesis chapter 43. When Joseph has seated his brothers for a meal and the Egyptians are serving, it says, "And they served him," that is Joseph, "by himself, and them by themselves," that is the brothers, "and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians." So there is this inherent disdain for Hebrews amongst the Egyptians, and she uses this against Joseph. In verse 14, she says, "He has brought in a Hebrew," that is Potiphar, "has brought in a Hebrew to mock us." And that word is zachich, zachich, zadichet kuf. This is the same word, by the way, that is used when it describes Ishmael making sport with Isaac or mocking Isaac. It's the same word that's used when Isaac makes sport or mocks with Rebekah. And so the word seems to imply something sexual. In verses 16 through 19, Potiphar's wife relates this story to Potiphar himself, so that his wrath was kindled. Now, considering that he's the chief executioner, why didn't he just have Joseph killed? Either he was so fond of Joseph that he just could not bring himself to do it, or God moved upon his heart not to kill him, or he didn't believe his wife, but he has to save face. Chapter 39, verses 20 through 23, it says, "And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed." So ultimately, Joseph is put in charge because the Lord gave him favor with the keeper of the prison, but oftentimes the Creator works through people. So reading between the lines, is it possible that one of the reasons the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge is because Potiphar brought him there? And Potiphar could have, possibly, conveyed to the keeper of the prison what a fine and organized and talented young man Joseph really was. It doesn't say, it's conjecture, but it's possible. Now, as troubling as this would have been for Joseph, we understand in hindsight that it served God's purposes that Joseph should go to prison. Some commentators say that he was there for 12 years, one for each of the 10 brothers that he had slandered, and then 2 extra years for placing his trust in the cupbearer. Well, that's an opinion, but at any rate, it serves God's purposes that he should go to prison. I think the reason that he was there ultimately is because it's going to put him in the right place at the right time. If you consider what it takes for a baby to come into the world, well, first of all, you know, there's the seed and fertilizing the egg. Conception takes place. The baby grows and matures and develops with inside the womb. But when it comes time, the baby has to be positioned to go through the travail of childbirth. And without the travail, without the labor, the baby can't be born. And so for it to work according to the proper design of the Creator, when that baby matures, Joseph had to mature. When that baby develops, Joseph spiritually, emotionally, and even physically to some degree, had to develop. There comes a point in time that the baby has to be in the right position in order to go through the travail. Because again, without the labor, the baby can't be born. So in other words, Joseph had to be there. Because if Joseph isn't in prison, then how could he meet the cupbearer? And meeting the cupbearer has a direct relationship to him being summoned before Pharaoh. And so he's in prison ultimately to serve God's purposes. He's being positioned to go through the travail, so to speak, so that the baby can be born. Because God's purposes were for Israel as a nation to thrive, but also to be a light to others. And so Joseph, again, had to endure the suffering of the prison and being sold into slavery in order that he might be in the right place. Because, again, if he can't interpret the cupbearer's dream, how will the cupbearer know to tell Pharaoh that Joseph can interpret Pharaoh's dream? It had to happen. If that doesn't happen, if he doesn't interpret the one dream and then is summoned to interpret Pharaoh's dream, then how can he be in the right place at the right time to be in a position to save all of Israel? And so what we see in the story of Joseph is suffering is a prerequisite to glory. The Messiah verifies this for us. In Luke chapter 24, verse 25, he says, "And he said to them, O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things, and I'll insert the word, then enter into his glory? Suffer first, enter the glory after that." Paul writes in Romans 8, verse 17 and 18, "The Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with the Messiah, if we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him." Again, notice the suffering is the prerequisite to the glory. And then Paul goes on to say, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us." So, Joseph's story is teaching us many things, and one of them is, if you want to enjoy the glory, if you want to realize the glory, then you've got to be prepared to endure the suffering. You have to be positioned to go through the travail in order for the baby to be born. Now, as we come on over into chapter 40, verses 1 through 3, it says, "Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. And he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined." That is, Potiphar, apparently, is over the prison, ultimately. And he put them in this prison where Joseph was confined. So, apparently, these are the two men who were responsible to taste the king's food, to drink his wine before it was given to him. And so there's speculation here as to whether or not there was a plot to poison the king on one or the other's party. Nonetheless, they were placed under Potiphar's custody in a ward awaiting trial. In verse 4, it tells us that the captain of the guard, that is Potiphar, charged Joseph to be with them, and he ministered unto them. In other words, Joseph was assigned specifically by Potiphar to be with these two men as an attendant. It seems to me that if Potiphar distrusted Joseph so, that he wouldn't have done this. So he couldn't have distrusted him too much. But this act is what will eventually bring Joseph to the attention of Pharaoh. Now, verses 5 through 7, it says that both of these men, providentially, of course, dreamed a dream about their future. And upon seeing them the next morning saddened, Joseph inquires as to what the problem is. And so in verse 8, they said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." So it's obvious that God is the one who gave them the dreams, as well as giving Joseph the interpretation to the dreams. So these are two very important dreams. They play a role in a bigger story, Pharaoh's dream. And interesting to me that Pharaoh's dream and then the dream given to Nebuchadnezzar, those are the two, as far as I'm concerned, most prophetic dreams in all of Scripture. And so notice that the most prophetic dreams were given to pagan kings, but they were not given the interpretation. In this particular case, they're given to these men, pagan, we're assuming pagan or idol worshipers, but they weren't given the interpretation. And so in all accounts, God will give them these dreams, but he will not give them the understanding of the dreams. That had to come from the man of God that was already positioned, and he had to be in the right place at the right time in order to serve God's purposes. And so Joseph, who, as we know, is well acquainted with dreams, thinks God may give him the interpretation for them. So in verses 9 through 13, the cupbearer recounts his dream, and Joseph interprets it. And when he interprets his dream, he requests of this very important official, make mention of me unto Pharaoh. Remember me to Pharaoh. And he tells him, I was stolen out of the land of Hebrews, and I have done nothing wrong. Perhaps the cupbearer is probably thinking, yeah, that's what they all say. But at any rate, that's what Joseph says to him. Now, when he says this, that's the first time that's on record, at least, that Joseph speaks up about his innocence. And if this was the exception, if this was the only time he said anything, then Joseph is a great man of faith and patience. However, there are some who deduce in his saying to the cupbearer, remember me to Pharaoh, that he is placing his faith in a man now instead of God. Wouldn't he have known, or shouldn't he have been able to discern, that God was orchestrating this situation? And so was it necessary then to mention this to the cupbearer, or should he have just left it and to see what the cupbearer will do? Well, that's a matter of debate, I guess. But there are some who believe that Joseph is making an error here. In verse 16, when the baker saw that the interpretation was good, or positive, perhaps, then he told Joseph his dream. I'm sure that, considering the circumstances, both men were in fear of their lives, and now they've got these dreams. What do they mean? So the baker, he hears the good interpretation, or the positive interpretation, given to the cupbearer, and so he assumes that maybe he's going to receive the same thing. Of course, his dream and the meaning was not so encouraging, because the birds that are described eating from the basket seem to be the clue to interpreting his dream. The baker couldn't stop them. He was powerless to stop them. And so that means that he was dead. So for both men, they get the interpretation, and what they come to understand that this is all going to culminate in about 3 days, because the one, the cupbearer, had a dream that involved three branches that put forth fruit. The baker had three baskets on the top of his head that the birds were eating out of. For them, it's all over in 3 days. But for Joseph, it's going to be 2 more years. And so as we come toward the end of the Torah portion in chapter 40, verses 20 through 23, it says, on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all of his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. Here's what that means. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And so as we come to the end of this Torah portion, all of these different things that Joseph has gone through has been a prophetic view of the Messiah. Not just the Messiah, but the body Messiah. But we'll focus on the Messiah for the moment. So do these dreams that were given to the cupbearer and the baker, do they have any prophetic significance outside of those two individuals? In other words, is there something we can see that hints to us about the Messiah in these dreams? Consider these things. Joseph speaks to the innocent of the two men and says, remember me. To the guilty one, Joseph pronounced that he will hang upon a tree. And Joseph will be in prison. He will be waiting for 2 more years. At Messiah's crucifixion, there are two that are accused with him. One, who's going to be restored, says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. The other, who is unrepentant, he's guilty. He dies guilty, hanging upon a tree. And the kingdom, though presently with us, from that vantage point, waits another 2,000 years before all will acknowledge him as king, before he will come and be taken to Pharaoh's house and people will be kneeling before him. Just something to consider. But with that, we come to the end of this Torah portion. Vayeshev, hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.